Hello, and welcome to The Record on KUOW on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Marcy Silman, in today for Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW, and you can find us on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Just hours after the recent Florida shooting, these terms started to trend on Twitter and on Facebook. Hashtag gun control, hashtag gun reform now. Well, you might think the trending topic emerged organically, fostered by some of the millions of Americans who are on those social media sites. In fact, flooding into the conversation were tweets sent out by hundreds of Russian bots. Their goal? To spread disinformation and to deepen the divide in the conversation in this country. Sam Woolley thinks a lot about bots and how to manage what's going on right now. He directs the research of the Computational Propaganda Project at Oxford University when he's not in Seattle working on his PhD at the University of Washington. Sam, welcome to The Record.
Thanks for having me.
You are talking to a bot idiot. Let's start with that term. We hear it thrown around a lot, but what exactly is a bot?
At its most basic level, a bot is just an automated piece of software designed to do something that a person would otherwise have to do online. Bots have existed online since the internet was public. They're an infrastructural element of online life. A lot of the time, though, when we talk about bots, we talk about social bots, which are automated software programs built to look like people and act like people. Oftentimes, they're built to spread particular types of information, and they're not necessarily good or bad in and of themselves, but they do exist widely on sites like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
So we're hearing a lot about bots, not just in the Florida shooting aftermath, but also as Robert Mueller continues his investigation of what's going on with Russia. My big question is, how do I know, since I'm not face-to-face with an actual human, if I'm interacting with a person or with a bot?
It's really challenging. Increasingly, bots and the people who launch them are becoming more sophisticated. So in the way that they think about how manipulation occurs. So Facebook and Twitter don't do a lot to let us know whether or not we're talking to a bot. They have their own internal rules in their terms of service that prevent high degrees of automation on their sites. However, as we've seen with the Mueller investigation, but also with other political events, the platform's control of misuse of social bots and automation has failed.
Well, we're going to come back to that in a second, Sam Woolley, but I'm curious how the bots actually work, because as I was reading in particular in this recent indictment that there were bots that were working to support Trump and bots supporting Bernie Sanders and bots trying to organize various kinds of rallies. So what actually happens?
Right. So bots are used on social media oftentimes to amplify communications, to give the illusion of popularity to an issue or a candidate or an idea. During the 2016 election, bots were used to drive up traffic surrounding Donald Trump. They were also used to influence publics during key events throughout the election, whether it was the debates or other pivotal times throughout the election. The 7 days preceding the election, my research project studied the way that bots were driving particular hashtags surrounding the candidates, and we found that bots amplified speech about Donald Trump at a rate of 5 times more than they did for Hillary Clinton. And the goal a lot of the time here is for the bots to both disinform people, so spread fake news, but also to generate confusion. And a lot of the Russian bots were built to simply confuse and create arguments and even offline protests so that the American public wasn't really focusing on the real issues, but they were focusing on specific splinter issues or other things.
Sam, you mentioned that Facebook, Twitter, other social media sites do have some capacity to confront and deal with bots. Are they willing to use that?
Facebook and Twitter and Google as well, because Google owns YouTube, have shown some willingness to address the issue of bots and the ways in which they drive disinformation on their platforms. However, all of these companies, in particular Facebook, have scaled it at such a quick rate that I think they kind of let things get a bit out of hand. And so They've come to the table to discuss how manipulation occurred during the 2016 U.S. election, but prior to that, teams like my team and others were doing research that showed that political manipulation and manipulation of social groups using bots and automation on social media were happening all around the world. We wrote case studies on Venezuela and Mexico. We spent time studying cases in Turkey, the Ukraine, South Korea. And so there was a bit of willful ignorance about this problem. And the social media companies now have to begin addressing the problem and taking steps to mitigate the misuse of bots and of manipulative anonymity in particular.
I'm talking about bots with Sam Woolley, who's an expert on computational propaganda, a title I've never heard before. And Sam, you said that these sites have to start doing that. That's your opinion. That's not something enforced by law, is it?
Well, increasingly, it is something that's going to be enforced by law and regulations. Countries like Germany and Brazil are putting laws on the books to deal with this problem. The United States is considering something called the Honest Ads Act to prevent misuse of political advertising on sites like Facebook. The companies themselves have discussed these ideas with Congress. And even in the city of Seattle, there's laws on the books that discuss what should and shouldn't happen with political advertising. And there's requirements about disclosures of who is attempting to manipulate us during elections. Until now, a lot of this has been ignored or by the platforms, and the platforms have also flown under the radar in terms of their role as media companies. They've sort of used this phrase, "We are not arbiters of truth. We're not media companies," when in fact they do curate information. They show us particular things in our news feed. They show us particular trends using algorithms that they build. So they do have a vested interest, and I think that the law will hold them accountable eventually.
You mentioned that the city of Seattle has some laws on the books. I understand the city's also been trying to get specific information from Facebook. What is that information?
I think that the logic from the city, but also from Washington State writ large, is that Facebook and other social media companies have shared information on political advertisements from Russia and from other potential external influencers during the election with the Mueller investigation. And so why haven't they shared them with Seattle? Because Seattle and the state of Washington have laws on the books that suggest that political advertisements must be disclosed to the city and the state. The idea here is that when we had TV and radio influencing us, it was important for us to know who was buying the ads, who was selling them. But now that Facebook is interacting directly with the campaigns, Facebook, Twitter, and Google all had embedded employees with the Trump campaign, working with them to harness political communication in an effective way. We need to know exactly who's buying and selling these advertisements and who's working to manipulate the American public. There's laws on the books from the Federal Elections Commission about foreign actants interfering in American elections, and that's what we've been seeing in 2016 and what we'll likely see in 2018.
It's interesting. Right now, we are tweeting out facts from the show, portions of our conversation. Twitter especially has been a vehicle for politicians and journalists to either gather information or send out or to do both. So how damaging is it to have this bot disinformation floating about on sites where a lot of us are trying to get at the truth?
Right. So Twitter, it's particularly damaging on a site like Twitter because Twitter is a space where perhaps we don't have a larger majority of the public hanging out like we do on Facebook, but we do have a lot of journalists and politicians spending time on Facebook and also getting breaking news from Twitter. And so the problem here is that there becomes a sort of manipulation of those in the highest positions of power, of influencers. And in fact, Douglas Gilbo of the University of Pennsylvania and myself wrote a paper called Computational Propaganda in the U.S. Election. And we found that people in the highest levels of influence, be it Donald Trump, Sean Hannity, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, all of these people in U.S. politics were actively engaging with bot-driven content on Twitter, or also resharing or retweeting or liking it. And so we were able to deduce that bots really had an effect on the flow of information during the 2016 election.
And ultimately, how did that affect us as the citizens of this country?
I think it affects us because it prevents us from having genuine discourse about the issues. It really prevents us from being able to know what is true and what's not true, and creates a massive amount of distrust in media institutions writ large. Right now, we don't know what the effects of bot traffic and disinformation were upon actual votes. It's really hard to determine that. But there's increasingly more and more experimental research showing how these things affect us in the way that we think.
So all I'm flashing on right now, Samuel, is an image of Samuel Payne taking out his soapbox and standing on it in the town square to talk about whatever it was that, that he believed in. Mm-hmm. We didn't know whether that was true either. I guess now it's even more confusing, and I'm wondering what we as consumers of all this content can do to either vet or at least try to protect our democracy.
Right. You know, and if Samuel Payne had been standing up on the soapbox and there was 10,000 robots in the crowd supporting him, we'd be even more concerned. The idea is that automation and anonymity have really driven this issue and created a new form of propaganda. And consumers, they have a role, sort of a twofold role. One is to let their local Congress people know that they are concerned about the lack of oversight of social media companies during elections. So they should let them know that they want laws on the books to track political advertising to prevent misuse of bots and automation. But also, consumers have got to work to educate themselves. There's groups like Hamilton 68, which have built a dashboard that tracks Russian propaganda. Mm. There's First Draft, which is located out of Harvard, and they track and do fact checking, mostly around fake news. And then there's Data and Society, which is a institute in New York that is doing a lot of great work on the alt-right and the spread of disinformation. And lastly, there's my new lab at the Institute for the Future. It's called the Digital Intelligence Lab. And we're really working to bring tech companies to the table to discuss this stuff and to generate collaborative solutions to this problem.
Well, Samuel, we're going to be following the progress of that as well. And audience, we will have those resources at our website. You'll find it at kuow.org. Samuel Lee is Director of Research of the Computational Propaganda Project at Oxford University. And I guess, Sam, in your spare time, you're getting your PhD from the University of Washington.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in Seattle, and I'm going to get my PhD soon. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Record from KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Marcy Silman in for Bell Radke, and welcome to the Year of the Dog. Happy New Year, everyone. Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations began in earnest over this past weekend, and like every good party, the celebrations involve food. In fact, food might be central. Xiaoqing Chao knows all about food. She's an award-winning food journalist. She's a cooking instructor, and I testify, I've taken her class. And now she has written a cookbook. It's called Chinese Soul Food. Xiaoqing, thanks for coming in today. Great to see you.
Thank you, Marcy. I always love having conversations with you.
I always like eating food. I've always thought Chinese food is wonderful, but I've never thought of it as soul food. So before I talk more about what's in this book and a little bit about how you came to get to it, tell me what you mean by that term.
You know, a lot of these dishes are everyday home cooking dishes that I grew up with and a lot of other Chinese people have grown up with. So none of these dishes break any new ground, but they're very familiar, very warming, and a lot of times they're peasant food.
So soul food, meaning it's your soul. It's what was familiar to you and what's familiar to a lot of people.
It feeds our souls.
Now, you did not grow up in China. You grew up in the middle of America, in Missouri, but your parents were immigrants.
I was an immigrant too, but both my parents were born in China, and then they fled China and grew up in Taiwan. I was born in Taipei, but I grew up in the United States. So we're in a family of immigrants.
How did you end up in Missouri, of all places?
We ended up in Missouri because of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Both of my parents had received graduate degrees there. And they ended up staying in Columbia because they have had an American dream. And the stereotypical story. I mean, they couldn't do what they did, so they opened a restaurant, and I grew up in that.
I mean, how old were you? You were young when that restaurant.
Gosh, I think I was about 7 or 8 when we started that restaurant, and I started by making wontons. I made all the wontons for the restaurant, and we did dishes on the weekends, et cetera.
I don't necessarily think as of academics as, you know, great home cooks, but were they great home cooks before they decided to open a restaurant?
They had to be great home cooks, just because we were living in the States, and they're in a small town, and it's cheaper to cook for yourselves, and also you get to have the familiar foods that you like.
So what is your earliest food memory?
A couple of things. I remember standing in the little kitchen that we had in our student apartment, and couldn't see to the countertop. And I remember my mom or dad cooking whatever the food was, dumplings or rice or whatever the meal was, and just standing and not being able to see over the counter. But it was always in the kitchen. So that's an early food memory. And the other is we would walk down the street, and we had in the summers in Missouri, they would have like mulberry trees just on the sidewalk. And we'd pick mulberries, and I remember making Jiffy Cake. One of my first recipes that I made on my own was a Jiffy Cake with mulberries in
it. With mulberries. I'm talking with Xiaoqing Chow, and that recipe is not in her new book, Chinese Soul Food. But dumplings, wontons, all of those recipes are. You write in this book that it was probably before your parents opened their restaurant, 6 or 7, you were making these dumplings with your dad, I think. Is that right?
Well, for dumplings, like pot stickers, I remember in our little apartment, because all of my parents' friends were also students who were from Taiwan or China, and they would get together for just to get together or for the holiday, Chinese New Year, and move the dinner table out into the middle of the living room, and just everybody would make dumplings. So that is an early memory, and we didn't have a Chinese rolling pin, so my father sawed off the end of our broom handle, and that was the rolling pin.
And I should say a Chinese rolling pin, because I have one, is about, what is that, like 1.5 inches in diameter?
Actually, they're about 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch in diameter, and it's a glorified wooden dowel, basically. They're straight-edged. They're not tapered like the French style, and they're about 12 inches or so in length, give or take. But you want that shorter length in the straight edge to help make it easier to roll out the dumpling wrappers.
Now, there are dumplings that go in soup. There are dumplings that don't go in soup. There's dumplings that you eat with a dipping sauce, all of which are in this cookbook. I took this dumpling class, so I know this firsthand. My dumplings were not as beautiful as the picture of the dumplings.
So
what's the trick?
So I don't ever want anybody to think that they have to make their dumplings look exactly like the picture. You don't have to make your food, whether it's my book or somebody else's book, you should never think that you have to match the image.
Because that's good.
The photos don't always tell the truth. And let's be real, this is home cooking. Every single time you make something, it's going to be slightly different. And with dumplings, you know, everybody has a different style of pinching, and that's quite all right. My dumplings look different from my mother's dumplings.
And now your mother lives with you, so you have a chance to like compare firsthand, right?
We don't compare. We just get it done so we can eat.
Did you make dumplings for the New Year's over the weekend?
I did. I can't make any meal and get my family together without making dumplings, because it's just easier for me to do it. And so my brothers and their kids and families just love have it coming to my house for dumplings.
I'm talking with Xiaoqing Chow. You may have been around Seattle long enough to remember she was a food writer for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And now she is the author of Chinese Soul Food. She also cooks classes at the Hot Stove Society in downtown Seattle. I want to go back to your girlhood for just a little bit. I grew up in the Midwest, and I don't remember any authentic Asian restaurants or even ingredients. You know, there was sort of Kikkoman soy sauce, maybe. So how was that different in Missouri? Was Columbia, Missouri a font of Asian culture?
No. not at least not when we arrived. We ended up in Colombia probably mid to late 70s, and I remember we would have to drive to Chicago to get to kind of stock up on some core ingredients. Over time, that changed, and we did get an Asian market, and then St. Louis and Kansas City had distributors, and as a restaurant, we would be able to get ingredients from the wholesalers.
But you do include in this book, I think you call the chapter Guilty Pleasures, Chinese restaurants weren't necessarily making Chinese food.
A lot of Chinese restaurants are a means to an end. It's a way to raise a family and have a business, and so the food isn't always the most authentic. We wanted to appeal to our customer base, and the customer base had a perspective on what Chinese food was to them, and they wanted things that were very cheap and plentiful and lots of fried foods and you know, sweet and sour pork and cashew chicken and those types of things, which, there's nothing inherently wrong with those dishes. They may not be what I would serve at home for my family. There are a lot of dishes that we didn't even know existed until people asked for them.
Wait, customers would come to the restaurant?
Oh,
they would
like,
make chop suey?
Yeah, no, it would be like, at first it was General Chow's chicken, which, you know, everybody loves deep fried chicken nuggets with a sweet and spicy sauce. But when we first started getting requests for that, we didn't know what it was. Or crab rangoon, which is the cream cheese wontons that have the fake crab in them. We didn't know what that was because they're cream cheese does not exist in the Chinese diet. But we eventually made those things because that's what people wanted. And when we didn't have them, they would turn around and leave.
So were your parents, did they learn to cook from their parents and then they brought that to a restaurant?
No, they were self-taught. And when we first opened the restaurant, we did hire a chef to come cook for us and learned a few things from him. And then when he needed to leave, we took over.
So you would hire a chef from another Chinese restaurant. That person maybe knew how to make crab rangoon and things that...
Because there's a whole network of these cooks who
sure.
go from restaurant to restaurant. And I don't remember the exact story of how we came upon this particular chef, but, he helped us open the restaurant and we learned a few things and went from there.
You did not go into the restaurant business. You went into the journalism business. And then the circumstances of the journalism industry led to a change in career. But while you were in the journalism industry, you weren't writing specifically about Chinese food. You were writing about all kinds of food.
All kinds of foods, a lot of sustainability issues related to farming and how we come to our food. So my interests were far broader. And as a journalist, you should have a broad interest for sure. And it was mostly about storytelling and using the lens of food and cuisine to talk about more universal values and beliefs, family and togetherness and all those things, community.
Food is very central to, I would argue, most cultures, if not all cultures. I don't know all cultures, so I'm just going to qualify that a bit. But I'm curious when you left the PI and you started doing other things, did you then channel your food writing energy specifically to Chinese food?
It happened over time, but that's the short of it. I realized that, as I was, first I had two kids, and so I was trying to feed my family very inexpensively and quickly, and I just fell back into stir fries and all the dishes that I knew could be done very economically and quickly, literally with my child wrapped around my leg.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that your American students have about cooking Chinese food?
All the prep work. I think that's the biggest misconception, is that the prep work in advance of actually doing the cooking is hard. So all of the cutting of the ingredients and gathering some of the spices and such, they look at the list of ingredients and immediately get turned off by what visually looks like a long list of ingredients. And typically they're not any longer than the average, you know, non-Chinese recipe, but they put up this wall. And then when they come to class, we make, for example, a stir-fried chicken with baby bok choy. And they don't even use a wok. They come into cooking class, and because the cooking school has skillets instead of woks, they use skillets, and they make this food, and it's delicious.
I did make some dishes out of this, and I get the impression from reading it that this is a sort of a guide. I want to follow certain things. For example, I want to have garlic, ginger, soy, oil, sesame oil in my house. You really tell me, okay, if you don't have baby bok choy and you've got broccoli, use that. Or if you don't have chicken and you have shrimp, use that. These are sort of templates that I can fill certain things in with, right?
And that's how a cook of any kind cooks, is they look at what they have and then they riff. But they base it on principles of cooking. So in this case, it might be stir fry or making a dumpling. Whatever the ingredients are, you can adapt that to the technique. And the other aspect is that I don't want any of this, like I don't want the lack of anything to be a barrier. So I want to meet people where they are. If you want to get into all the regional cuisines and then the fine points of Chinese technique, there are so many cookbooks out there that do this. My friends and colleagues have done an amazing job of documenting all of this. So there's so many resources, but what I'm interested in is getting more people into the kitchen. And in order to do that, you have to give them an on-ramp.
What's the most important things that I need to have in my pantry if I'm not going to fully outfit things?
So a good soy sauce will carry you a long way. And I would say that, again, everybody's familiar with kikkoman because that's what everybody has. But if you want to cook more Chinese food, go get a Chinese soy sauce. And I give some recommendations for that. They all taste different. So get one Chinese soy sauce, maybe get some sesame oil. I really like white pepper, although if you don't have that, that's okay. But soy sauce, a little bit of the sesame oil, maybe some a vinegar, like a mild unseasoned rice vinegar, because that will take you a long way as well. You want to have rice for sure. You know, maybe some hoisin sauce. And I love having a chili sauce, but a Chinese-style chili sauce that isn't sweet, because a lot of people go for the sweeter Southeast Asian-style chili sauces. We don't want that in this kind of cooking.
So if we like to cook a variety of Asian foods, and I count myself in that, I need to have all the Vietnamese ingredients, Thai ingredients, Chinese ingredients, Indian ingredients?
You know, it depends on whether, I mean, if you're interested in it, then yes, you should stock your pantry with the global pantry. But there are some things that overlap. And again, like if you want to cook across different cuisines and you have one soy sauce, I'm not going to stop you from making my food because you have kikkoman, right?
Right.
That's the antithesis of what I'm looking for.
And at least in the Seattle area, a lot of places to go find those ingredients.
Yeah, indeed.
Xiaoqing Zhao is a Seattle food writer and a cooking instructor. Her new book just out is called Chinese Soul Food. And trust me, you can do this. Xiaoqing, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
You're with The Record here on KUOW. After a lot of rain here in this region, you might have heard us say something like this on the air.
Amtrak has canceled passenger train service between Seattle and Everett for the next 2 days.
Yep, landslides on railroad tracks along Puget Sound frequently delay trains, and that made one KUOW listener curious.
Why were the train tracks between Seattle and Everett built in areas prone to mudslides?
Good question. That's from April Eisenhower in Redmond. Reporter Anna Boyko-Rywak sent out to find the answer, and she learned the story's muddier than you might think.
First, though, the simple answer.
Economics.
Kurt Armbruster is a railroad historian. We'll talk with him more in a moment, after the muddy answer. The wheels of a freight train squeal against the tracks at Carkeek Park in North Seattle. I'm standing on a bridge over the tracks with Dave Montgomery and his black lab, Loki.
Loki didn't seem too impressed by the train. If it was a milk bone, it'd be a different story.
Montgomery is a geologist at the University of Washington. When railroad executives built these tracks in the late 1800s, they were messing around with a geological process that had been going on for a very long time. On one side of the tracks is a beach. On the other side are steep slopes.
These coastal bluffs, these steep areas right along the shoreline, have been moving back away from the sound and eating into the landscape, you know, for almost 15,000 years.
Montgomery says one reason is what's in the hills. Sand, clay, the occasional boulder, sediment left by glaciers.
The nature of the materials are fairly weak. We're in a pretty wet region, and there's steep slopes. Those three factors are what really conspire to make the bluffs potentially unstable.
In the past 3 years, landslides have disrupted or canceled passenger trains along Puget Sound over 500 times. 500 times. Around this time last year, a landslide sent dirt and some trees onto the tracks at the very park where we're standing and delayed train service. It covered a few feet of tracks. So these slides are not like the 2014 Oso landslide, a massive tragedy that swallowed a neighborhood. But they're not always benign. Occasionally, they hit a train, like this 2012 incident near Everett that pushed a few freight cars off the track. No one was hurt. So back to our listener's question. What were railroad builders thinking when they put the tracks here? Historian Kurt Armbruster says Seattle and Tacoma were booming mill towns. Everett was getting into lumber, too. And businessman James J. Hill spied an opportunity.
He saw that the Pacific Northwest was poised to be a real economic center.
Armbruster says the businessman wanted to connect the cities west of the Cascades with a railroad. But you've probably noticed we have a lot of hills. The most efficient route would have to be flat.
And the easiest, cheapest, most efficient way to connect those cities was right along Puget Sound.
So in 1893, the Great Northern Railway began to run right along Puget Sound. Over 100 years later, we humans are still meddling with our landscape, and we're making landslides worse. Armbruster says historical records don't show the kind of frequent landslides we have now, probably because more trees anchored down the soil. Up the hill from Carkeek Park, a busy street runs along a block that used to be covered in trees. Geologist Dave Montgomery says clearing old-growth forest causes more landslides.
You know, we've paved over a good portion of the upland surface. And what happens when you pave over a surface? Rain that falls on that surface is going to run off quickly and go wherever the pavement directs it.
Including down a steep, muddy slope and onto the train tracks. Montgomery says we've made this naturally unstable terrain a lot more unstable. Railways and government agencies are trying to make up for that. Recently, the state spent $18 million to protect train tracks around Mukilteo and Everett. The state says the construction worked for those areas. In other places, though, the slides continue. For KUOW, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Carkeek Park.
If you have a question about news in the region, anything, just ask us. We will try to answer it. Go to kuow.org. If you follow football, and maybe even if you don't, you know the Seahawks had kind of a rough season last year. They didn't make the playoffs. A lot of the players were out with injuries, and now rumors are swirling about who will and will not be on the field next season. Well, whoever the players might be, they'll face not only the expectations of their fans, but also brutal hits. Our next guests say those hits are not a bug in the game. They're a feature of football, and a lot's going to need to happen for that to change. With us is Catherine Foley. She's health and science reporter for the publication Quartz. She recently wrote a piece called Football Will Keep Killing Players Until We Change the Way It's Played. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And in the studio, Michael Sean Dugar, who covers Seahawks for the Seattle PI. And I bet, Michael Sean, you'd prefer not to talk about concussions, but that is what we're going to talk about today. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Catherine, as part of the reporting for you, your piece, you actually learned how to tackle like a football player. So if you would, can you put us physically in the space? What is it like to tackle?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've always played sports, although never contact sports quite like football. So I was working with some players who had played at the University of Washington and were linebackers at the University of Washington, and they were specifically teaching me a type of tackling that doesn't involve my head. So basically, they stood there and they had demonstrated this tackling for, I don't know, 25 tackles or so before, and then they said, okay, now it's your turn. And they gave me a rundown of what I should be doing with my body. So they gave me a couple of tips, you know, make sure your hip is above your knee, make sure your arms snap in this particular way. And then they said, just go for it. And it's not an intuitive move. It was not an intuitive move for me. I think I ended up just throwing my body at this former linebacker. And it was really painful, much more. It was a hard hit.
Well, so Michael Shawn, what I see big guys mostly on football fields kind of lunge at the opposing team. And I always thought it had something to do with below the waist and shoulders. So can you talk a little bit more about the traditional tackle?
Well, there's depending on the position, there's like rules. There's like a tackle zone. So like if you're a quarterback, you know, you're big money, face of the league, face of the team, you can't get hit like below the knees or above like your shoulders, right? So then you got like a zone. But if you're a running back, like you're a free-for-all. Like we can hit you anywhere and as hard as we want. And usually you get paid more if you hit people as hard as possible. So there's like a zone depending on, you know, what you do. If you're a receiver trying to catch the ball, if you leap for it, like you're not supposed to get hit above your shoulders. Or so, you know, you get hit in the head or neck area. There's all these rules, but I mean, it's hard to really follow those when like you're making split-second decisions and you're big, strong, and fat.
Well, because the idea is to stop the person with the ball from going to the other end and making points. So
stop it
however you can. So, Catherine, what happens physically and mentally before someone takes a hit of any kind?
Well, some of the players I had spoken with were saying that, you know, they wanted to play the game and they wanted to listen to their coaches and they trust their coaches and teammates. But it does get really mentally wearing to know that you're going to take that kind of impact, and that's just part of the game. So in addition to pushing yourself to your limits physically, you're also going to feel like you got hit by, you know, a huge man running full force at you, trying to do everything he can to stop you. So I think you can sort of see it sometimes, too, when players, you know, for a split second, if they are tackling, brace themselves just before the hit, because both players who are being tackled and tackling know it's going to hurt. So, yes, absolutely. It's, you know, I think it creates a culture where you feel like you have to push through no matter what and you have to tough it out. And, you know, football is a fantastic sport, but it's certainly the mental aspect is different from any other sport, I would say, anticipating that kind of pain.
Yeah, because I'm thinking as you're speaking that I would be running as far away from them as I can. Michael Shawn, what have you seen?
I think the analogy that people like to use with football, right, is car accidents. You know, like just because of the impact and the damage. So like you take a car accident, right, and you put your seatbelt on. But when you put your seatbelt on, when you get in a car, you hope the car doesn't crash. When you're a football player, as soon as you step on the field, you know there's going to be a crash.
Yeah.
Actually, crashes are encouraged depending on what side of the ball you're playing on. And it's like most football players have accepted that, yes, I'm going to get in a crash today, which is why they pray beforehand, which is why some of them go into a dark space before they head onto the field, because you can't be normal, like mentally, and play football.
So, Michael Shawn, it's part of the game, but I hear that actually in practice, at least the Seahawks don't tackle each other.
Yeah, you won't see tackling in practice because it's funny, right? So you won't see some of that is league mandated, like especially in the offseason.
Yeah.
But like you won't see tackling in practice, right? Why? Because it's too dangerous. Well, I mean, you do it. Yeah, you know, think of it that way. We can't practice this thing because it's too dangerous. But when we go out there, well, yeah, we're gonna do it. It doesn't become any less dangerous. It's just, you know, people are paying to see it, and you get a check for that. That's the difference. Okay. But it's just as dangerous. It's still a car accident.
Wow. Michael Shawn Dugar covers the Seahawks for the Seattle PI. Catherine Foley has written at length about concussions in football at Quartz. And Catherine, we started the segment talking about how you learned how to tackle. You actually learned that at a company here called Atavis that's trying to make it a little bit safer to tackle the Seahawks are working with this company. And I'm curious, is there a direct connection between this new form of tackling and the fact that they really didn't do all that well this season?
You know, that was outside of what I was looking at for this particular story. And I don't think there's sufficient data to say that the two things are, that the Seahawks' seasonal outcome and tackling using the shoulder style are related. I would say that I think Atavis is aware that implementing a new type of tackling does mean that there is a bit of a learning curve for teams, although, it's just too much to say whether or not the Seahawks taking some time to tackle this way and learn to tackle this way, whether that affect their end gameplay. But they do realize that it is perhaps one thing that might be holding other teams back from adopting this style of tackling.
Michael Shawn, you watch the team. I know Pete Carroll's pretty committed to this. What do you think? What have you seen?
I think that what's going on with, like, you again, you can't prove, like, really that no matter how you change the tackling or how you change the helmets or how you change whatever, as long as there's tackling and all these guys are this strong, this big, and this fast, like, football's going to hurt no matter what you do, right? And it's friendly fire as well. You know, Cam Chancellor on the Seahawks, he's one of the best, nicknamed the Enforcer, a.k.a. I hit people hard. You know, he's out there being so wild and so good at his job that he's even hurt teammates on accident. You know, his collision with Richard Sherman hurt his elbow for the Super Bowl 2015 and then took out Earl Thomas, you know, last year, this past season, just hurt himself in his neck and may never play again. It's like, there's no way. And he does it the right way, quote unquote, that safe, that rugby tackling, take your head out of it, and he may never play again.
You mentioned hit his head. So, Catherine Foley, you learned about tackling, but you also write about helmets. And I understand there is a new type of helmet that may help prevent concussion.
Yeah. So also while I was out in Seattle, I visited Vice's headquarters. They had launched their helmet at the start of the 2017 season. It's called the 01. And unlike traditional helmets, it is built with plastic columns on the inside, so it's a quote-unquote soft helmet. When I visited their headquarters, I was in their smash lab, which is where they beat these things up, and I could not, I mean, it takes a pretty big smash the helmet to get it to bend or deflect the hit. These helmets have been shown in labs to decrease the force that a head feels when, you know, getting hit at a similar speed to what football players face on the field. However, there is no yet relationship between, there's a bit of a relationship between the force of impact and concussions, but there's no data that show that these helmets can actually prevent concussions in any way. It's a reasonable line of thought, but, you know, if you're wearing the helmet, you're still going to get hit, presumably. And additionally, a lot of scientists are concerned that it's not necessarily the hit on the head or the initial impact. It's actually the way that the neck snaps and the brain moves around in the skull as a result of getting hit on a different side.
Wow. I'm just put my hands up on my head because this is scary stuff you're talking about. So, Michael Shawn, we could change a helmet, but there's still other body parts that are contributing to injury, in particular concussion?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the helmet stuff, I love the helmet research, and I loved her piece as well because it was really good, really detailed. But I see all, like, the helmet research everywhere, and it's like, kind of funny because, like, there is no safe cigarette. You know, you smoke it, it's bad for you, you know, because of what's in it. You know, there's no way. You know how you prevent getting hurt in a car accident? You don't crash. You know, there's no safe way to crash.
So are you saying that we should abolish football?
Uh-oh.
Wait, this is your bread and butter, so be careful.
Yeah, no, I still like the football helps the checks clear. So, I mean, they can play, as long as they're cutting the checks for me, they can play, hit their heads all they want. I've never had a concussion playing football. I did have one in a car accident. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough.
And you're using your hands, taking notes on the field. That's Michael Shawn Dugar, who covers the Seahawks for Seattle PI. Catherine Foley, do you think we should abolish football?
You know, I think that football has a lot of really great virtues to it. It's like any sport where it teaches you discipline and teamwork and humility and how to lose and win with grace. I think that there have to be some serious changes if we want to protect our players. And I think they do deserve our respect and protection because, you know, as I said, when you are exerting yourself as much as any other athlete at whatever level you are, you know. There's that plus knowing that you are going to get hit with what feels like a car crash. And I think that is sort of a side of the American spirit you don't really get to see anywhere else. So I think that, you know, from a science and health perspective, I think that scientists and engineers working in this field owe football players everything they can give to make the sport somehow safer. Because I think, you know, abolishing it entirely would mean negating all of the work that these players have put in over the years. And that, to me, seems like it just invalidates everything that they've done. I also think that, you know, there is an if the rules of the game could be changed, that would be great. But as you said, Mike, you know, as it's played now, it brings in a lot of money, and the NFL in particular isn't going to want to budge on that because so much money is at stake.
We're talking about football and concussions specifically with Catherine Foley and Michael Sean Dugar. And you can join our conversation on Twitter at KUOW. And Shannon wants to know, what about removing all football gear the way they do for rugby? It seems like gear changes and improvements would like help with this brain injury.
All of it, any solution you want. Well, you have to take tackling out. You have to take the hits out. Right. Like you have to, if you hit people, it'll hurt. You know, that's boxing. That's, you know, baseball, basketball. You hit people, it hurts. Like I can scientifically say that for a fact. You know, you hit people, it'll hurt no matter what else you do.
OK, so I have a question then. I remember when my brothers were little, they played flag football. There were little things that hung from Velcro strips. Would there be an audience? Would Americans go for non-combat football?
I think what we need to realize with football too, whether we're talking about changing it to non-contact or even like abolishing it or it fading away, some people think it'll be like extinct in like 50 years. Football isn't just a game, right? Football is real close to being almost like a religion. Like you go to some areas and football is king. Go to Texas and watch some football and see how people treat it. You know, football, there's this, the line in the movie Concussion, football has a day of the week. And it's not that you have a day of the week. They took it from Jesus. Like, they have Sunday. Like, that's, you don't just abolish that, you know? They have a full day of the week dedicated to it.
I have to say they have almost every day of the week at this point dedicated
almost, yeah.
to the NFL. Well, Catherine Foley, what if it was like Buzz Lightyear in the movie Toy Story with like a big bubble dome? Would that protect football players?
You know, I think there are a lot of things that could protect football players, but I think the issue is, would the game still be the same without them? So I think whatever solution, I do believe that it is feasible that engineers and scientists can solve this problem. I don't think that anything is on the table just yet, and I don't think a massive space suit would be a suitable solution for players. I don't think people would want the game to be played that way, both players and viewers.
So, Michael Sean, I'm assuming covering the Seahawks, you talk to the players. What do they say about this?
About concussions?
Yeah, and about what they want.
They want their heads not to hurt.
Yeah.
But also, they want to, you know, be stars. They want to play the game they love. They want to, you know, be able to feed their family. That's like, it's the give and the take, and it's risk versus reward, and it's a risk that obviously hundreds and thousands of guys are willing to take.
What would they be willing to do to protect themselves?
I think they're all for like the safety precautions. Like a lot of them, they'll tell you, like, I'm not a doctor. If you tell me something's safe, I'll listen to you. Like in our piece, yeah, I listen to my coaches, because that's in football, you train to do what you're told. They'll do that, and they'll also sacrifice, and they'll say, I'm fine. You know, because again, as was mentioned, like, yeah, it does like engineer this, like, oh, you play through this, and you're tough. Like that's more important than to them than a lot of this.
Do the Seahawks players that you've spoken to resent this new kind of tackling that they're learning how to do?
Oh no. They're okay with it. I think Michael Bennett right now is I think he's in like New Zealand or something like that, and just visited with a rugby team like this week and talked about, yeah, no, rugby's good. We like that. We like the style of tackling to take the head out of it. Because, I mean, your head is your most important.
Yes, it is. But rugby players don't even wear any kind of pads, so it always seemed dangerous. That's a whole other conversation.
Right.
Catherine Foley, what do you think needs to change?
That's a great question, and I don't know that I have the answer as a health reporter. I will say, just to jump in, talking about the rugby-style tackling, I did notice that if you do the thing properly, you can actually get more power out of your tackles, which could presumably be beneficial for players who are trying to take others down. To me, it seems like there needs to be some sort of rule change at the national level to somehow, you know, make more dangerous style tackling illegal, or maybe even make it so that football players have to adopt some sort of safer shoulder-led tackling, or everyone has to wear protective gear, perhaps like the 0-1 helmet. However, I don't think that those are perfect solutions because, as you said earlier, Mike, you know, players are always going to be hit. And I think that's just, the game is just really, really dangerous as it is. And I think that the science, it is possible to somehow come up with a way to save these players, either through better equipment that protects players' necks and sort of works like a seatbelt that allows them to move their heads slowly, but at certain speeds, you know, snaps in place so that they're not obtaining concussions.
But
I'm not. I don't think it's there yet.
We're not there yet. Catherine Foley, a health and science reporter at Quartz. Michael Sean Dugar, Seahawks reporter for the Seattle PI. And really quickly, Richard Sherman, in or out?
In.
Okay. Well, that's all for today. I'm Marcy Silman. Bill Radke's back tomorrow, I think. Thanks for listening here on KUOW.